You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. MIT professor and author Noam Chomsky is one of the world's best-known dissidents. He's written dozens of books about politics, propaganda, and American foreign policy that have been translated and distributed around the world. And the New York Times has called him arguably the most important intellectual alive. Chomsky is also the guest on this week's edition of Clear and Present Danger, Peace Watch's continuing series exploring the challenges of free expression in an open society. Speaking with host Stephen Rohde, he began by discussing the media's ability to manufacture consent and the effects of propaganda on our democratic institutions.
The phrase manufacturing consent is not mine. It comes from Walter Lippmann, who was the maybe leading public intellectual of the 20th century and the dean of the American media. This is in his what are called his progressive essays in democracy back in the 1920s. He was a Wilsonian liberal, and he was also in Woodrow Wilson's propaganda commission called the Committee on Public Information, which was established in order to drive a pacifist country into raving anti-German fanatics, and it was very successful and impressed a lot of people, including the public relations industry, which recognized that these are great ways to control people's attitudes and beliefs. Impressed Hitler, writes about it in Mein Kampf, and it impressed liberal intellectuals like Walter Lippmann, who argued that what he called manufacturing of consent is a new art in the practice of democracy. The practice of democracy, according to Standard Picture, involves, quoting Lippmann again, there is an ignorant and meddlesome outsiders. That's the population. That's what Andrew Hamilton called the great beast. They're the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, and they have to be kept marginalized. They are allowed to be spectators, but not participants in political action. Their function is to appear periodically, and select one or another of those called the responsible men. It's called an election. And then they're supposed to retreat into some private concern and let the responsible men run the world of affairs. That's the conception of democracy in technical terms. It's now called polyarchy. And that's what Lippmann and other liberal intellectuals have generally advocated. And he was discussing it in the context of the of several things. First, the enormous successes of the propaganda agencies of the First World War, which showed how this could be done, and also a change in the country, both in England and in the United States, the two more democratic countries. It was simply becoming more difficult to control the population by force. There was an extension of the franchise. There were labor unions, England, not here, a parliamentary labor party, other kinds of organizations. And it just meant you just can't control people as easily as before. And therefore, it was necessary to turn to a new technique of control, namely propaganda. The term was used openly then. That's manufacturing consent. The public relations industry, which also grew very fast on the basis of the same ideas, one of its gurus, Edward Bernays, and he developed what he called the engineering of consent. It's about the same. The idea is to control people's attitudes and beliefs by careful public relations. And that has since grown into an enormous industry, maybe one-sixth of the total gross domestic product. Well, these are the ideas, and they are standard. The notion of the propaganda model, which was largely developed by my co-author, Edward Herman, simply describes the mechanisms that enter into the way the media end up choosing topics and filtering the way they're presented. And there are obvious factors that enter into this. It's almost truism. So ownership is a factor. Advertising influence is a factor. Reliance on sources like government is a factor. And there are a number of other factors that interplay to yield a media product, which tends to be quite supportive of power. Well, that's the model. It's more or less it's a pretty innocuous free market model. The real question is, does it work? the media are huge corporations, most of them owned by mega corporations. Like other corporations, they sell something to a market. The market, in this case, is advertisers. That's where their income comes from. And what they sell is audiences. And for the elite media, the ones that more or less set the agenda for others, the product that they sell is privileged, educated audiences. So you have a system where huge corporations are selling privileged audiences to other businesses. And it would be a kind of a miracle if what came out of the media was not geared to the interest of the sellers, the buyers, and the product. And in fact, it is.
In the last 20 years, how has dissent been marginalized through the application of these notions of manufacturing consent and the propaganda model?
In some ways, dissent is less marginalized now. There are actually conflicting tendencies at work, so it's kind of hard to judge. There is one tendency towards consolidation and restriction of the range of media options. The person who's done the most work on this is Ben Bagdikian. He publishes a book called The Media Monopoly. The first one was in the early 80s, and I think there were about 50 independent media sources in the United States. The most recent one that I saw a year or two ago, I think it was down to about 8. And this concentration and monopolization is, in fact, international, so it's happening worldwide. Well, that, of course, reduces the diversity and options available for discussion, debate, and so on. And that coincides with another tendency towards reduction of content and increase in what the media are, after all, concerned with, namely advertising. In fact, if you talk to somebody in the PR industry, they'll tell you that when they speak of content and fill for a television program, the term content refers to the advertising, and fill refers to the car chase in between that keeps people looking until the next ad comes along. So the energy, creativity, financing, and so on goes mostly into the content, that is the advertising. The other stuff is just to keep the audience there until the next ad comes along. And this is also a technique of control. I mean, it's trying to induce attention to what are called the frivolous things of life, like fashionable consumption, to get you maxed out on 5 credit cards and so on, so you don't interfere with the responsible men. And this is, of course, increasing, so that reduces opportunities. On the other hand, there are counter tendencies, which I think are important. The counter tendency is that since the 1960s, the general population has just become a lot more civilized and has changed in many ways. This creates pressures on the media and all institutions, and it also leads to development of alternative media. The Internet's a case in point. And all of this tends to have an effect in the opposite direction.
Where has the media gone astray from the roots of free speech and a free press that was created by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights?
We haven't gone astray. The Bill of Rights does not say that we should have honest media. There is nothing in the Bill of Rights that prevents the development of media which are in the hands of what amount to private tyrannies, that's what corporations are, and that sell their products to other private tyrannies. That's not contrary to the Constitution. In fact, it's rather consistent with the conception of the Founding Fathers. Remember, they didn't want democracy. You want to find out what Madison wanted, you don't read the propaganda. In fact, you don't even read the Federalist Papers, which were propaganda. You look at the debates in the Constitutional Convention. And he's an intelligent man, made it very clear. He said, what we have to make sure is that power remains in the hands of what he called the wealth of the nation, the more capable set of men, and the rest must be marginalized and factionalized. And the reason is because it's only the wealth of the nation who understand the permanent interests of the country. And the permanent interests are to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. About 100 years ago, a major change was introduced with what's called the corporatization of America. That's when massive private tyrannies, and remember, that's what a corporation is, massive private tyrannies were granted the rights of persons by the courts. That means First Amendment rights, Fourth Amendment rights, and so on. Fourth Amendment rights means they're immune from inspection. First Amendment rights has been interpreted to mean they have the right to propagandize us. By now, the private tyrannies have been granted rights that go far beyond people of flesh and blood. The recent trade agreements give them rights that humans don't have. These are critical developments of the past years which have reduced the threat of democracy, and there are plenty of others. Take, say, financial liberalization, which was introduced about 30 years ago. It was understood right away that that would have a major effect in undermining democracy.
In terms of threats to freedom of expression in America today, are the Bush administration and John Ashcroft a greater threat to freedom of expression, or the what you've called self-imposed totalitarianism and the uniformity and obedience of the U.S. media?
I don't know how to rank them exactly, but the Bush-Ashcroft tendency has a real fascist streak in it. I mean, there is no doubt, when you look at what they're trying to do, that they would be delighted to destroy the freedoms that have been won by hundreds of years of struggle. And some of what they're doing is simply outrageous. Ashcroft and the others around him clearly would like a very powerful state. They're not conservatives. They're statist reactionaries. They want a very powerful state which will work for the rich and will control the population and impose discipline on them in every imaginable way. And they're exploiting the terrorist threat for this purpose.
At the Penn Center USA, which sponsors this program, and Penn International, we're equally concerned about threats to freedom of expression around the world. Recently, you came to the defense of a publisher in Turkey who had apparently the audacity to publish one of your books and was threatened with criminal punishment. What were you able to achieve in that case?
He was brought to trial because in a collection of essays of mine that he published, one was a transcript of a talk that I gave at an American U.S. university on the U.S. and the Middle East. And in that talk, I had a few sentences on Turkey, which were essentially drawn from Human Rights Watch reports. And that was the specific thing that he was brought to court for and would have gone to prison. I was asked to go, and actually Human Rights Watch also asked me to go, and so did Penn. And I did. I attended the trial there and, in fact, tried to present myself as a co-defendant. There was a lot of international attention, not much from the U.S., but there was a lot of international press there. These are state security courts, basically military courts. It's clear that everything is pre-planned. Within a few minutes, the prosecutor had announced that he's withdrawing the charges, and the judge accepted it. It's obviously pre-planned, and it plainly had to do with the publicity, which was substantial. However, it goes on. The Turkish intellectuals are an extremely impressive group of people, I should say. It's not like the West. So leading writers, artists, academics, journalists, others, are constantly not only protesting, but engaging in active civil disobedience against these draconian laws. In fact, they used the occasion when I was there and the publicity to publish a collection of banned writings, including writings of people who are in jail for their writings. They asked me to be a co-publisher, and I was.
Renowned author, intellectual, and dissident Noam Chomsky speaking with Stephen Rohde as part of Peace Watch's Clear and Present Danger series exploring the challenges of free expression in an open society. The series is a production of Penn USA and the Pacifica Radio Archives. The executive producer is Deborah Jones. The producer is Eileen Moskowitz. And the editor is Mark Torres. Tune in to Clear and Present Danger next week as British journalist Robert Fiss talks about his years of covering the Middle East and how the political pressures faced by American journalists covering the same conflicts cause them to report entirely different stories.
Private power.
private power, highly concentrated private power, private power, private, private power, highly concentrated, unaccountable private power, private power, private power, highly concentrated, unaccountable private power determines what goes on. Vast private power. Nobody has a word to say about it. Nobody knows anything about it. Highly concentrated, vast, unaccountable private power. Nobody has a word to say about it. Nobody knows anything about it. Concentrated, unaccountable, vast totalitarian system. Nobody has a word to say about it. And for the most part, nobody knows anything about it. Highly concentrated, vast, unaccountable private power, vast totalitarian control, vast concentrated totalitarian unaccountable private power determines what goes on. Nobody knows anything about it. Vast move towards a kind of totalitarian system. This is a business-run society, unaccountable business-run society, unaccountable business-run society.
Private Power by Paranoise. One of the traditional criticisms of the peace movement used by the right wing is that people on the left are often quite good at protesting, but often come up short when called upon to offer concrete solutions or alternative visions of how the world should be. But as the Bush administration launched its military campaign, orchestrating a regime change in Iraq, a popular slogan of many of the anti-war demonstrators was that regime change should begin at home. Among those taking the small steps to work towards such political reform is the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center, founded in 1996 to assist progressive groups in developing peace-oriented ballot measures and bolstering voter turnout. Peace Watch spoke recently with Jessica Markham, the center's program associate, about the advantages peace advocates can gain from learning how to properly engage their communities in a collective effort to affect positive social and political change.
The Ballot Initiative Strategy Center helps progressive groups use the initiative and referendum process to pass good public policy. We help environmental groups, we help unions, we help healthcare groups, we help civil rights groups, and I think that the initiative process might be an avenue for peace advocates as well. This woman in Ward 49 in Chicago, her name is Donna Conroy, she used the initiative process to highlight attention to the United States' involvement in the war in Iraq, and she did it in a very effective way, and in a sense, her initiative influenced the local election and the impact of who actually won. Donna Conroy decided to run a mock initiative in tandem on the same day as a local Chicago alderman election. It was a mock election, so it didn't actually have any bearing. And she put ballot boxes right next to the polling booths in most of the polling booths across Chicago. She basically ran a mock initiative, an initiative campaign. It was a non-binding resolution that said, should the citizens of the war oppose an invasion of Iraq by the United States? She wanted this question to be put on the February 25th election, which was the same day that Chicago's council members were going to be having an election as well. It was rejected by the Board of Elections. She approached the council members in Chicago and said, look, I know that people in this district are opposed to war in Iraq. The council members said to her, look, we're not going to be passing any resolution. So what she did next is she went around door to door and she collected signatures of people who were opposed to the war in Iraq. Once she collected a significant amount of signatures, I think it was about 900, she next approached the council members again and said, look, I have gone door to door and I know that people within your districts who will be voting on February 25th are opposed to the war on Iraq. Because these incumbents that were running knew that she'd gone door to door, they knew that she had a very good sense of what people actually cared about in their districts. So they turned around and they passed a resolution saying that they were opposed to the war in Iraq. Donna Conroy, the woman who ran this initiative, felt that her initiative campaign and her promotion of the issue in the media and to the politicians and to the public actually resulted in enough pressure being put on these incumbents and these aldermen to help them pass the resolution.
And so I would imagine listeners are saying, okay, that we can applaud her creative, resourceful, and persistent manner, but how do you translate that to the next step where you actually have an impact on preventing the wars from occurring or from getting that message all the way up the chain of command to the administration in order to avert what we just witnessed happening in Iraq?
Realistically speaking, it would be very difficult for peace advocates, unless they had a lot of money, to run a statewide binding, and by that I mean legal, initiative. I think that initiatives can potentially be a wise avenue for local groups to mobilize people. Gathering signatures is a very practical and pragmatic way of getting people together and creating a community. To get people out to vote in the November 2004 election on certain issues, such as whether they're supportive of candidates that are opposed to war in Iraq or not. And going back to Donna Conroy, although the council members chose to pass that resolution, she decided to run a mock election anyway. And she felt that by putting mock ballot boxes next to the polling booths, it brought out a certain kind of vote. And she noticed that the people who had chosen to support her resolution won, and the people, there was one person who chose to not support her resolution, and he lost.
Did this become a full-time job for her?
She spent $2,000 and had 20 committed volunteers. And it was so empowering for her, and she felt that she's really mobilized her community, that she's now planning to pass a non-binding resolution on the more extreme measures of the Patriot Act.
So it's your opinion that this initiative process can be a very effective political tool for those in this country that want to try and have an impact on the decisions that are being made around our foreign policy?
I think the initiative process is something that peace activists might want to consider, particularly on a local level. I think that if you're a peace activist, it's a very good way of creating a community and of getting people out and mobilized and organized. Creating initiatives can also influence what issues the media talks about during the election cycle. I mean, if you put an initiative on the ballot, the media are going to be talking about it. The media are going to be presenting this particular initiative to the candidates that are running and asking them whether they are for this initiative or not.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about the process of actually getting the initiative on. What would be required of the activists interested in trying to have it placed on the ballot?
Okay, if you're going to go on a local initiative level, you need to think about it in terms of what powers the local governments control. They control your schools. Local laws control what you actually teach in the schools, whether they teach peace studies, for instance. Some aspects of the Patriot Act relate to the information that can be gathered from people who use local libraries. It also relates to local laws regarding the police force, where you can protest, when you can protest, how you can get a permit. Also, local roads, local ports, local businesses that might be creating products that are supporting the war effort. And I think that if a peace advocate is considering running an initiative on a local level, they would need to consult a lawyer and also check to see whether the initiative process is applicable and even available within their locality.
Jessica Markham is the program associate at the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center. Finally tonight, as the economy falters, the Republican Congress pushes through tax cuts for the rich as their solution, and Bush files his papers for re-election. The Christmas Coup comedy players at Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York present this satirical skit on Bush's strategic plan, both here at home and abroad.
We take you now live to the Oval Office, where Vice President Dick Cheney and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice are arriving for a meeting with the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
Well, where's the President, Condi?
I thought he was with you, Dick.
What's this?
Looks like the President left us a note.
Oh, yeah.
When he uses the purple crayon, it usually means he's worried about something.
Dear Condi and Dick, I am worried they will blow up the Oval Office.
Was I right or was I right?
Yep. That is why I want you to be there.
To meet with me on speakerphone.
From a secure location.
Where do you think he is?
I don't know. I told him the Washington Monument wasn't safe.
Hmm. That flashing light is the president, Dick. We better take his call.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Turn him on. Hello, Mr. President.
Hello, Mr. President. Hello.
Condi, Dick?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah. Did they blow up the Oval Office yet?
No,
Mr.
President.
That's, no, the White House still stands.
Our war plan is working.
Yes, it is, Mr. President.
It's a good war plan, Mr. President.
It works because it's simple. Three simple steps. Easy to remember. One, two, three.
Well, yes, Mr. President.
Three simple steps.
What are they, Condi, and what are the three simple steps of our war plan?
Kill enemy, Mr. President.
Yes.
That's right, Condi. Yeah. Kill enemy. That's number one.
Limit damage.
Limit damage.
Sky's the limit. Sky's the limit. Don't worry.
Oh, you limit damage, but that could be a high limit.
Yes, Mr. President.
Step two is a high limit damage.
Yes.
And thirdly, provide aid.
Provide aid? What's the fun of that?
Well,
get rid of that one.
Hmm.
Get rid of it.
Okay.
Get a two-step war plan.
Mm-hmm.
Kill enemy and inflict high-limit damage. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, providing aid is how we cash in on our war, Mr. President. It'll make us rich.
I am rich, Dick.
Well,
so are you.
Yeah.
The rich get richer, Mr. President.
Yeah.
I suppose so. That's what I like to hear, Condi.
Yeah.
Rich get richer.
Rich get richer.
It's my dream for America.
Yeah.
And the poor get to fight for the war.
Yeah.
They get killed. Their family receives a nice flag. Isn't that right?
Yeah, it's a full-sized flag, Mr. President.
Not just a flag pin.
Absolutely free.
Free.
It's a free flag, Mr. President.
Someone pays with his life, the family gets a flag.
Ooh, my heart goes out to wealthy Republicans yearning for another tax cut.
Yes,
Mr. President.
That is why I have decided to charge for those flags.
Charge the bereaved families, Mr. President?
Where does it say you get a free flag?
Well, it doesn't, Mr. President.
The money we could make selling flags to the families of our fallen military will pay for the tax cuts for wealthy Republicans.
Those flags cost the government $19 each, Mr. President.
We will charge $100 per flag, Condi.
Ooh.
If the family wants more than one flag, this way we can eliminate the problem of the mothers and the widows fighting over the one flag.
Well, you know, those fights can ruin a funeral.
The president has eliminated that problem, Dick.
Yes. That's right, Dick.
Yes. Yes, Mr. President.
And besides, those flags, also available for purchase by Gold Star family members, dig this, the new Iraq of Freedom tote bags with matching gas masks.
The Christmas coup comedy players at Pacifica Stations KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. And our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA and Adam Campy. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. Send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.